one into Syria, the other to Jordan.
The Iraqi army launching airstrikes against ISIS positions in northern Iraq, trying to push the militants back as they continue their assault. And on the ground, Iraqi soldiers seizing weapons and vehicles and, again, engaging in firefights. But the Sunni militants continue to storm through the country, taking over border towns along the Syria-Iraq border, opening now an even wider supply line while occupying a huge swath of the northwestern part of Iraq.
Fox's John Huddy in the Middle East Bureau. Secretary of State John Kerry traveling in the Middle East, telling other Arab leaders to not give money to Sunnis in Syria.
We particularly discourage individuals in the region who may have been sending money through some innocent charity or through various back-channel initiatives under the guise that it's for the general welfare and benefit of people who've been displaced. But then that money finds its way into the hands of terrorists.
Kerry now in Jordan. He's expected to travel to Baghdad. The average price of a gallon of regular gas.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio. This is Veterans Radio. And now, your hosts for today's program, Dale Thronberry and Bob Gould.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. This is Jim Fossone. And
oh, you're not Dale or Bob, eh?
And flying with me is Bob Gould this afternoon. We've got a great show for you this afternoon.
Let me just say a little something, folks. This is Jim's inauguration. He has been working with us now for a whole month. He's ready to sit in Chair A, and here it is. Jim, congratulations.
So all the mistakes are mine, so that's fine. We've got a great show for you today. We're going to talk first about the plight of Marine Sergeant Amir Hakmati, and then we're going to talk about psychiatric service dogs and what they do for veterans. I think you'll find both of these segments very interesting. But before we get there, we want to thank our Veterans Radio supporters. Today's Veterans Radio program is sponsored by Legal Help for Veterans, your only stop that you need for veteran disability assistance. Also, Big Boy Restaurants, where all your Big Boy favorites await. And Applebee's Restaurants, a great place for family dining. And our local CPA, Len Petalik, over 25 years serving our community. All of our friends at Veterans Radio, please patronize these veteran supporters. And while you're there, be sure to mention that you heard it on Veterans Radio. We're going to move now to some upcoming events in the area that we want to inform you about. And certainly,
Lots going on, man.
Do you have something you want to tell our listeners?
You know, well, right now everybody's making plans. They're making summertime plans. Okay, where am I going to go? Well, one thing you can go to is the Yankee Air Museum. Thunder over Michigan, August 9th and 10th. Boy, what a deal that is. I mean, that is a day for the whole family, entire family, mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, bring them all, and kids under 15 are free. Boy, what a deal. They got food, they have entertainment, and they're going to have this year the Thunderbirds back.
An impressive power of air power and display.
You know, what's really cool when they do that, one's flying regular and the other one's up, so they're like canopy to canopy. You saw that in Top Gun. You can see it in person at the Yankee Air Museum. What a have you
what
seen?
What are the dates for that, Bob?
For the
air show at the Yankee Museum.
What's that?
The dates for that show.
Oh, the dates, 9th and 10th.
Of which month?
Of August.
There we go.
Well, we did. Yeah, we mentioned that at the top of the... Oh, we don't miss it. But if you want more information, you want to go to Yankee Air Museum. Yankee, that's with two E's. Yeah, man, how do you spell it? YankeeAirMuseum.org, not .com, .org, YankeeAirMuseum.org. And you can get some discounts if you order your tickets. Now, once again, it's for the whole family. There's plenty of places that camp around here, plenty of places around Ypsilanti, Ann Arbor, and Washtenaw County for RV, camping, motels, hotels, food. You got it. Come on down to the Yankee Air Museum, Thunder over Michigan.
I've got a couple, too, to announce. Tomorrow, actually, Monday, June 23rd, from 5:30 to 8 p.m., you can come out to the firing line in Westland and support General Carol Ann Fossone. It's a little fundraiser for her run for the State House.
What's the firing line?
firing line is a gun range. A lot of our friends are there, and including their big supporters here at WAAM. Another
Talk
one,
1600, of course.
You got it. Another one that you may want to put on your schedule is July 5th at the Wayne Ford Civic League in Westland, Michigan. You can come out and hear the Concert for America by the 338th Army Band. That's a free event, again, a good family event. Call for tickets. The phone number is 734-716-3432.
What's really cool, too, is they play Sousa and, Stars and Stripes, and it's out in the – if it's a beautiful night and you're listening to all that great, great patriotic military music. What's that phone number again, Jim?
It's 734-716-3432 on July 5th. We also want you to start marking your calendar for September 10th. The Canton Community Foundation is having its fifth annual Veterans Summit in Livonia. We get about 300 veterans and friends coming out to hear about all the benefits to which they're entitled. So put it on your calendar and look for that.
You know, that is a cool thing because I get called, I don't know what benefits I get. Well, where do I go for more information? Well, you can call the government. But you might be put on hold. Or you can come to this event. What's that event again?
It's the Canton Community Foundation, September 10th in Livonia. You can go to their website and look it up. And, again, we bring the VA representatives, we bring veteran service organizations out, we bring veteran disability lawyers, state of Michigan folks, everybody gets in the room. The veterans have a time to go have their individual issues dealt with. So it's a very unique outreach, and it has grown over the 5 years.
Wow, that sounds exciting.
We also wanted to mention that our friends at Veterans Refuge Network continues its veteran suicide awareness at 6400 Textile Road in Ypsilanti. Every night at 7 p.m., they put crosses out, 22 crosses a night, to remind us that that's how many veterans commit suicide each year in this country.
It's very solemn. I was there. It's a very, very solemn event and things to see. Mm-hmm.
So if you have an opportunity to would like us to promote some of your events, please email us at veteransradio.net. You can email Bob or Dale at veteransradio.net, or go to our Facebook site and post on our Facebook site. We'd love to have you follow us, and we'll help spread the word about your veteran-friendly events that are upcoming.
That's way cool. Way cool.
And we'll be right back after this to have our first discussion about the plight of Marine Sergeant Amir Hekmati.
Thousands of American troops have come home from Iraq and Afghanistan with post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injuries.
I don't think anybody who goes into combat could ever honestly say that they're not different when they come home.
Don't brush us aside and don't count us out.
Help the USO support these troops and their families. Donate today at giveuso.org. The wounds are invisible. The stories are real.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. Our first segment today is to discuss a situation you may not have heard of before, which is why we're bringing it to your attention. It's the plight of Marine Sergeant Amir Hekmati. And we have on the line, I believe, his older sister, Sarah. And she's going to speak to us about the situation that her brother finds himself in. Sarah, are you with us?
Yes, thank you for having me.
Let me set this up a little bit for our listeners, Sarah. Amir served in the United States Marine Corps from 2001 until 2005. He's a Flint, Michigan boy. He was stationed in Iraq as a translator as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003 and 2004, and was discharged as a sergeant and awarded the Combat Action Ribbon and Good Conduct Medal. I understand you are his older sister.
Correct.
And Amir is a twin, I understand.
Yes.
Can you tell me about Amir a little bit, the brother, the man grown up before he got into the Marine Corps?
Well, he was very family-oriented, really just all-American kid, was born in Arizona but grew up most of his life in Michigan and was on the hockey team in high school, played soccer. And then after his high school graduation, he was based in Camp Pendleton, and he served 4 years in the Marine Corps. And he was deployed to Iraq for 9 months and served there and really was proud of his service to this country.
Well, it does sound like the all-American boy there. I would expect an older sister to tell us a good story about him, but I was surprised to learn that he's a twin. And his twin sister, like you, I think, went to the University of Michigan.
Correct. He did. And this has just been devastating for her, as you can imagine. You know, they share birthdays together. They've just always been very close. And so having this situation happen, and really with no very uncertain future for her twin brother, it's just been devastating, not only to her, but to our family in general.
And, Sarah, I understand that your dad has a Ph.D. in microbiology and is a professor at a local community college. Can you tell us a little bit more about the family?
Well, my father has been a professor here in the community for over 20 years now. And sadly, over a year ago, he fell ill and was diagnosed with brain cancer. And for the past year now, Amir, for a long time, did not know about the situation. And so we were really uncertain as to whether to tell him this because, you know, he's languishing in prison, unable to be a part of my dad's, you know, chemo and everything that he's going through. Meanwhile, my dad is suffering, uncertain whether he's going to recover from this, and is being told that, you know, it's terminal. It's something that, you know, the life expectancy is very short with this kind of recovery. And then recently, a month ago, my father suffered a stroke and has been hospitalized at U of M. He is currently in a rehab in Ann Arbor and is really just trying to regain his strength to be able to function normally and walk and be self-sufficient. So as you can imagine, our family's just, you know, on so many levels, it's been a nightmare. It's something that you just maybe hear about in a newspaper, not something that you would ever imagine happening a normal family.
And Sarah, before we talk about what happened to Amir, I want to paint the picture of him as a veteran and as a brother and a son. He's your dad's only son, if I understand it right.
He's the eldest, so he's the first son. The twins were surprise twins when my mom had delivered them. She thought she was having one baby, so you can imagine the excitement of knowing that there's a boy and a girl. And then he has a younger brother and somebody that he's always wanted to maintain connection with, be a mentor to, and now is over there, feels just so devastated that our family is enduring all of this alone. And, you know, was really more concerned when he communicates to my relatives about us, our family, my dad, than he is about what he's endured. And he's endured so much suffering that he minimizes that a lot.
And when Amir came back from service, he had a couple of jobs and started his own business. Can you tell us a little bit of that, too, so that we can understand the type of man he is?
Right. I'm sure a lot of veterans can relate. It's just getting back into the normal life after being in combat. And he started his own linguistics company. He was a translator in Iraq, so he thought he could be useful in that avenue and being able to help different contractors domestically, whether it's private or government businesses that needed help with translation. And he was an entrepreneur as well. He was investing in real estate and really eager to start his career, but wanted to pursue an economics degree at the University of Michigan and was actually accepted at the University of Michigan to start in the fall, right before he had gone to Iran. He was accepted to go, and then when he was captured, obviously this, you know, all fell apart.
So let's move into the summer of 2011. Amir is thinking about going and visiting family in Iran. Can you tell us what his thought process was, and really what the rest of the family's thought process was?
You know, for the family, we were a little concerned and asked him whether he had explored how his military service here in the U.S. would be perceived over there. And we asked him, you know, is this a good idea? He said that he had inquired with all the right people. He had went to apply for his visa and all of his paperwork through the Iranian interest section in Washington, D.C., and actually raised that question before even attempting to go. And if he was informed that, yes, you know, him being a veteran would be a problem, then, you know, that would be a red flag and he wouldn't attempt to go. But he was told that, no, as long as he went to visit family and, you know, he's obviously there for family purposes, nothing political, and he went within the time frame of his visa, that it would be fine. So we went, and he actually was there for 2 weeks visiting relatives. When he arrived in Iran, it was August 14th. He was spending a good 2 weeks with relatives, and then on August 29th, he disappeared.
And the relatives there, I believe I read somewhere that it was his grandmother and other extended family members that he was visiting before he started sort of the track of going on to his education. Is that sort of what was
exactly
planned?
Exactly. Well, he had, the last time he had a connection with anybody from our extended family, we grew up in the U.S., born here, but had all of our extended family in Iran. He had only met my maternal grandmother when he was a child, and she was older. She's not well enough to travel and visit us again here. He had this stint of time where before he started at the University of Michigan that he could visit her. And he said, you know, let me take this opportunity now before it's too late. I don't know how much more time she has. And so he went there to see her again, but also to meet both families, like our extended family. Sadly, he had never met my paternal grandmother, and the first time she ever got to meet him was when he was in prison.
So this sounds like a pretty dutiful son and grandson to me. And what happened on August 29th of 2011?
Well, on August 29th, the family was hosting a family gathering. Amir was getting ready to go, and he had told the family to that he was going to meet them because he wasn't ready yet. And so they had arranged for a cab to pick him up at the apartment that he was, the cousin's apartment that he was staying at. So everybody went to the family gathering, and they noticed he never arrived. They contacted the taxi driver, and the taxi driver said that he waited there for him, but nobody showed up. So the family got worried. They went back to the apartment. They saw that the door had been busted into. His personal belongings had been taken, and it looked very apparent that there was a scuffle that had taken place in the home. So immediately the family got worried. We were worried because Amir had called our family in the States earlier that day and was talking about his plans to prepare to fly back to the U.S. and not having heard from him, and then them not seeing him at the gathering. We were all frantic. We called all the police departments, the embassy, the consulate in Washington, D.C., and nobody had any idea what had happened to him. And really, it wasn't until months later that there was any confirmation that he was actually taken into their custody as a prisoner. We were very concerned as to why this was taking place, and they were basically just saying because he was American that they were investigating his status in the country and why somebody who had never been to Iran was visiting after all these years, but really nothing substantial. And we were given this kind of false hope that once the investigation was over, he was going to be freed.
But that isn't what happened, was it, Sarah?
Not at all. In fact, we were blindsided with news in the headlines before even getting any notification from officials in Iran that Iran had captured a spy and that they were going to sentence him to death. That was how we were presented with this information. And mind you, on the back, you know, in the sidelines, we were being told that it was just a simple investigation. You know, for them, just a security measure that this young man has never been to Iran before. Why is he coming after all these years? And we reassured them that he's there because my grandmother, our family, we have relatives there. You know, my sister and I have even visited Iran. My mom and my youngest brother had just gone to Iran prior to my brother's visit. So we all went and came back and never had any problems. Amir felt that that would happen for him as well.
He ultimately, there was some trial of some sort, and he was sentenced to death on espionage charges that have now been overturned, I understand. What's his current status, and is he still in an Iranian prison?
Yeah, he is. In fact, the Iranian officials, what happened was on January 2012, they sentenced him to death. From January till March, he was in limbo. We were wondering, like, are they going to actually go through with this? Then the Attorney General and the Supreme Court annulled the death sentence. They said there was insufficient evidence for them to go through this and that they would revisit his case and order a retrial. We were just told a few months ago by the attorney in Iran that a retrial took place and that he was sentenced to 10 years, but that Amir was not present for this retrial. And now he's no longer being accused of espionage, but cooperating with a hostile government, and so which AKA is the United States. And then that means that they're holding against him his service here, which is what they're considering him cooperating with a hostile government.
And I think that's certainly what is alarming to all of our listeners and all of our veterans out there who serve honorably, come back and integrate themselves into civilian life, only to find that travel abroad may have unique perils with it. And we have on the line Congressman Dan Kildee. Congressman, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you bringing attention to Amir's situation. So thank you.
You're welcome. And I know, Sarah, you turned to Washington for help, and one of the folks who have been helping out on this is Congressman Kildee. Congressman, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the efforts that you've been engaged in.
Well, sure. I mean, for the most part, our goal has been to make sure that our government continues to press for Amir's release. And I've spoken to President Obama about this, spoken to Secretary Kerry, many others, and really just to make sure that it's clear to our government, to the Iranian government, to the Iranian people, that Congress is watching, and that the United States, the American people, are paying attention to how Iran handles this situation. From my perspective, it's really about a family that I've come to know and an individual who I've never met, but that I feel like is part of my extended family, Amir. And so I'm doing everything I can to just simply make sure that his case continues to be in the forefront, and it's on everybody's minds as we move forward.
Well, it's much too easy to forget about these sort of situations, and I'm glad we could bring it to light a little bit. I mean, a 10-year sentence just seems incredibly long for doing nothing other than visiting your family and having previously served as a Marine. Is there any opportunity here for this to be commuted and for him to be released to U.S. custody, Congressman?
Well, at this point in time, really, the decision lies with the Iranian government. Clearly, they have the authority to make any decision that they choose to. The question for them, do they want to make a clear demonstration that they're serious about attempting to rejoin the global community? There have been negotiations, for example, related to their nuclear capabilities that are a step toward their entrance back into the international community. So they could make a tangible demonstration that they're serious by releasing Amir, and that's what we hope that they do. There's an opportunity now for them to do so. We hope that they seize upon it.
Sarah, we have a lot of activity going on in that part of the country at the moment, the world really, and I wonder whether or not your hearts escalate and plummet with all of that activity, wondering how it's going to impact Amir's stay in Iran and how long he ends up staying.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we do hold our breath anytime we get something in the headlines that is negative in relation to the U.S.-Iran relationship. Amir has made it very clear numerous times. He's extended letters to Secretary Kerry, Foreign Minister Zarif, and has also made it clear in these open letters that he has nothing to do with these political issues, and that he wants his unconditional release. He's an innocent man. And, he really is made that a priority to extend that message across the board in both nations. We obviously know that politically some of these things are out of our control, and we hope that it doesn't become a factor in the negotiations for his release. We want him to be home so that he can be with our father and you know, have our life back to the way it was before.
I know there was a lot of activity surrounding his 1,000th day in captivity,
right.
And that helped get the word out. I think most of us can't really think about being locked up improperly for that long. What types of activities, Congressman, are being done in the Washington area to kind of keep this in front of the President and the Secretary of State and others? How can we help?
Well, certainly this sort of broadcast makes a difference. The more the American people are aware of Amir's case, it just gets attention, and that gets to the people who are making these decisions, both in our country and across across the globe. We work on multiple levels. Obviously, the 1,000th day was important that we commemorate it, so we call attention to the fact that Amir is still being held. But we have discussions with our own government, with others as well, and we're just pursuing every avenue we can. Obviously, it's a situation where we have to be careful and strategic about how we manage this case. We don't want to make matters worse. But I think the most important thing is to make sure that people within Iran and within the Iranian government know that the American people are paying attention, and that we will ultimately across the globe make our judgments about their position in the international community based in part on how they deal with this case.
Well, sir,
can I add something as well
to
that? To your listeners, a lot of them may not know that Amir is actually the longest held American in an Iranian prison to date. Today will be 1,027 days. His 1,000th day actually fell on Memorial Day. And to commemorate that, Secretary John Kerry issued a statement asking Iran to release him. So, I mean, we do understand that the U.S. government is putting their effort in. I hope that your veteran listeners can go to freeamir.org or our Facebook page, which is Free Amir Hekmati, and just help to be a voice for him and advocate for him. And there's different ways that they can help.
That's great. I was going to ask you to pass that information along to our listeners. I mean, the Hekmatis have lived the American dream. Your dad is a professor. I know you've gone on and have your master's in social work. Your husband's a doctor. I mean, these are folks who have made the American dream and offered a son up into the service of the country. This is really heartbreaking for all the veterans who are listening. I would certainly hope that we can seize that opportunity and go to freeamir.org and go on to the Facebook site, which I did not make a note of. So, Sarah, tell me the Facebook site again.
It's Free Amir Hekmati.
And Congressman Kildee, I know they live in your district and really appreciate all that you continue to do for veterans. Thank you for keeping this in our consciousness. We'll keep reminding our listeners of it on Facebook and on our website. And thank you.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. It was Staff Sergeant Henry Irwin's job on the lead B-29 to drop a phosphorus canister as a marker when they reached the assembly area over enemy territory. Details after this. If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800. Erwin positioned the canister in the launch tube and pulled the pin at the pilot's orders. The flare dropped and then flew back into the plane. It exploded in Irwin's face, spewing flames just feet away from tons of incendiary bombs. Smoke filled the aircraft momentarily, blinding the pilot and co-pilot and putting the plane in a steep dive. Irwin dropped to his knees and, unable to see, felt for the canister. Although it was burning at 1,300 degrees, he picked it up, cradled it to his body, and began crawling to the cockpit.
He yelled to the co-pilot to open the window and threw the flare out. The crew then turned its fire extinguisher on him and began to feed plasma into his arm. Doctors were sure he was going to die and transferred him to Guam. Major General Curtis LeMay recommended him for the Medal of Honor and got authorities to expedite the award so it could be presented before he died. 1 week after the attack, LeMay presented the medal to Irwin at a bedside ceremony attended by the rest of his crew and his brother. Irwin surprised doctors by surviving. He was flown home to Alabama, where he was hospitalized for 2.5 years and underwent numerous operations. Henry Irwin died on January 16, 2002.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio on WHAM 1600 Talk Radio. Our website is veteransradio.net. We want to thank Applebee's Restaurants, which is a proud sponsor of Veterans Radio, for the best in family dining. You'll want to make any Applebee's restaurant your destination for plain good food, service, and complimentary military discounts.
You know, really, they have on Mondays, they have 30%. Can you believe? All you got to do is bring some ID, and you can get your military discount card, Jim.
We refer to that as Military Mondays at
Military
Applebee's.
Military Monday. And the rest of the week on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you get 10% off your meal. Isn't that cool?
That's at Applebee's Restaurants. They help us here at Veterans Radio deliver our program to you, and we're
and
glad to have them as a sponsor.
And it's great food.
Absolutely. That brings us to the next portion of our program. We have an interesting discussion on psychiatric service dogs. We have on the line Jennifer Petrie of Stiggy's Dogs. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely.
Having us on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And we also have on, I believe, Tom Jones, one of the veterans who has is working with a service dog.
Yeah, how's it going, guys? Thanks for having me.
Hey, Tom. Good. Glad to have you. So let me start this up. I think we're waiting to get one more on, but we'll start. Jennifer, tell us what Stiggy's Dogs is about.
All right. You know, our mission and our motto is rescuing one to rescue another. We are a 501 nonprofit, and what we do is we transform shelter dogs into individually trained psychiatric service dogs for our military veterans living with PTSD and TBI. And I know that sounds like such a mouthful, and it's hard to kind of break it down here for you.
Could you tell us, Jennifer, a little bit about how one trains a dog to be a psychiatric service dog?
Oh, boy. You know what? We have started this program now for about 4 years, and it's really taken a long time to really fine-tune our program for this. So it's very individually trained, very specifically with the dog and with the veteran. So, you know, first we interview our veteran, and then we find out what their specific needs are, and then we go and we find a dog that is going to suit what their needs are, their lifestyle, perhaps what their hobbies are, and then we pair them together. It's kind of like a arranged marriage in a sense, and then we work together with them. And depending upon what the veteran's needs are, is depending upon how our training will go.
And one of the things that's unique about Stiggy's Dogs is the type of dogs that you train into this service. Tell us about that.
Yes, we do. You know, we're a firm believer of rescue dogs, shelter dogs. There are many wonderful dogs that are out there sitting in humane societies and foster dogs and mixed breeds, and they make wonderful service dogs, and you know they fit and work really well into our program.
I also noticed that you have been able to place service dogs with veterans from all of the services?
Yes, we do. Yep.
And
all of the branches, yes.
And are these dogs which just end up helping the guys out, or do you also have placed dogs with some of the female veterans?
Oh, no. We have all military veterans from all branches, and male and female, and all types of dogs, all mixed breeds. And so far to date, we've placed and working with 41 different veteran and dog teams. So when you go to our site, you can look at them. And, you know, each dog has their own story, and each veteran has their own story, and then each team kind of has their own story, and each family. So it's really been a wonderful experience from beginning to end to see the transformation that takes place with the dogs,
so
with
Jennifer,
their veterans, and with their families.
So, Jennifer, you said everybody has a story. There is a story to why the name Stiggy's and why Stiggy's Dogs got started. Maybe you can tell us that story, too, because there's a veteran involved.
This is the hardest part, you know, for me to talk about, but, you know, it's the reason why we have Stiggy's Dogs. And, you know, you say Stiggy, and people always look at you, or it's mispronounced wrong. And so kind of the backstory of that is really why I named it that. So my nephew, Ben Castiglione, he was a Navy corpsman, and he was attached to a Marine unit. And he was killed in Afghanistan September 3rd, 2009. And, you know, like the Marines, saying Castiglione was kind of hard, so Stiggy, Doc Stiggy, you know, was their call name for him. So, you know, I really wanted his name to live on. I wanted his legacy to live on. You know, he didn't have to be deployed and to go back there for that tour, and he chose and went up to command to be able to go back there because he wanted to make sure that, you know, he was taking care of his guys.
We're about here at Veterans Radio, the stories of our veterans. So give us a little more. Where did Doc Stiggy grow up? When did he join the...
He grew up in Howell, Michigan, and where he grew up is where we've come back to when we just moved back here and established this 2 years ago of having this be here. And we're actually in, you know, on the property of the home that his grandparents had built that, you know, he was raised at, and, you know, his pets are here, and, you know, there's so many memories, and it's everything's kind of just come into full circle, and, you know, he's still helping take care of his guys and gals, you know, now.
That's excellent. That's excellent. I know that service dogs have become more widely recognized throughout the country. Are you part of a larger network of service dog trainers?
You know, yes, we are. And we really were nationally, and we have about 13 of our dogs that do live in other states. And every state has different laws, which that's a whole other topic and conversation on that, too. But we recently changed our program to start to open it up so we could actually start to pair more veterans. And to do that, we're doing that locally. So like, right now we have 12 different dog and veteran teams working together, and they're all from Michigan, and that's one of the largest classes that we've had gone through so far. So it's great.
I believe, Jennifer, we now have Brian Gans also on the line, who has one of your service dogs. Brian, are you with us?
Yes.
That's great. I'm going to start with Brian because he's had his dog for the longer period of time here, and then we'll turn to Tom. Brian, tell us a little bit about your veteran story. Where did you grow up? When did you join up? Why did you join up? And give us a little of that.
I grew up in the Rochester, Michigan area. Went to junior high and high school there. And I signed up when I was a junior. I did the delayed entry program. And then when I got out of school, that's when I went in and did my tour. I was with the 1st Ranger Battalion, and we ended up jumping into the island of Grenada, a low-level parachute assault to save rescue the students that were being held hostage.
Sure. And when did you get out?
1985.
And along in your post-deployment period, where did you see that maybe a service dog, psychiatric service dog, might help you out a little bit?
Oh, I had been out for probably 25 years before I even knew about them. And just with the different symptoms I was having and stuff, you know, going to the store and having panic attacks, and not really going out in public, not wanting to. And then I started, somebody had mentioned it, and I started doing research, and I said, yeah, I could, that would help me a lot.
And the along the way, I know you've been working, and tell us a little bit about your work history and how that fits into use of the service dog.
Actually, I'm not working now.
Ah, okay. I have down that you were the executive officer for the Midwest Ranger Committee for Veterans Rangers. So maybe that.
I'm the membership committee. I just make sure everyone keeps their dues paid up for the Midwest region of the United States Army Ranger Association. And I'm actually running for the Midwest director right now.
Okay, great, great.
Plus, we have the Michigan Ranger base going too, and I'm the executive officer of that.
Well, we always like to see our veterans stick together and continue to work and help other veterans. Tell me a little bit about Rusty. What type of dog is he?
Rusty's a boxer Doberman mix. He's 2.5 years old. Actually, he was real young when we started his training. We adopted him when he was 6 months old from the local shelter, the Dearborn Animal Shelter here. And we didn't have him a week when we started his training.
And what do you find that Rusty does the most for you in terms of being your service dog?
He does a lot. Like when we're out in public, he won't let people get close to me. You know, he'll create space for me. And actually, you know, I get in my moods where I don't want to go anywhere for a few days, and he will stay on me until we leave the house, where we go out into public.
So he helps you both get out and socialize, as well as when you're out in public, gives you that sense of security and protection.
Yes.
When we come back after a short break, we're going to talk some more about Rusty. But then we want to talk about Baxter. You got to love a name of a dog, service dog by the name of Baxter. So we'll be right back on Veterans Radio.
As a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, joining IAVA.org really helps in the transition home. It's a network of OIF and OEF vets like me who've got your back here, just like we did over there. That means when you need help navigating the GI Bill, we've got your back. And when you're dealing with the transition home, we've got your back. Or when you just want someone to share stories with, we've got your back. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org. We've got your back.
Brought to you by IAVA and the Ad Council.
And we're back on Veterans Radio on WAAM 1600 Talk Radio. And Bob, I think you have a question for our Army Ranger.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Brian, this is Bob Gould, 101st Airborne Division, baby. Yeah, how about all you Rangers out there? I trained a little bit with you. Tell me about, what's a low-level jump?
We did a 500-foot.
500-foot? Heck, that's like jumping off the back of a deuce and a half.
Yeah, pretty much. We actually took a vote on whether we were going to wear our reserves or not, and we decided we would, because if the cables broke, we still had 250 feet for our chutes to, it'd take 250 for our reserves to deploy.
Yeah, and it's enough time to make the sign of the cross, maybe twice, but a low level, how often did you train for that?
We couldn't jump that low in training. The lowest we would jump is 1,000 to 1,200 feet.
And Rangers and Airborne think this is fun, folks. Jumping out a perfectly good airplane.
Oh, man. Tell them, Brian, it's a gas, ain't it, baby?
Yes, it is.
Well, let me turn to a more sane Army veteran, Tom Jones. Tom, you've had Baxter for a little bit. Tell us about Baxter.
Oh, Baxter's an incredible dog. First, I'd like to say hi to Jennifer and Brian there. Thanks again, Jennifer, for still on the line. But yeah, we've Baxter and I have been together a little over 3 months, actually closer to 4 months. But the impact that he's had on my life and transitioning into the household, I have three kids under the age of six, so it's pretty hectic around there as it is. And he's just been a rock for me. You know, he's always been there. He's laying in my lap right now. So he's
Tom, tell us a little bit about where you grew up and why'd you join up, and what type of service you perform on behalf of the country?
Yeah, I grew up in Westland, Michigan. I joined. I was painting a warehouse on a 30-foot scaffold on September 11th, and I heard it all. I go down on the radio, and I lowered the scaffold, quit my job, and went and enlisted, and I got put on the delayed entry program for a while, and then I met up with my unit. I was also with the 101st Airborne Division. I was with the Balls Battalion, 2nd and 320th Field Artillery. I met up with them on the initial march. They were already there a couple months. I met up with them later around July 2003.
And then
came back, you know, did a couple tours in Iraq, and I got out at the end of 2006.
And how was your post-deployment time, Tom?
It's been, you know, a rough transition. You know, you go from being, trained to kill, you know, being the baddest you that you can be, and then when you come back, it's kind of a culture shock to come back and not be, that soldier with that training, and, you know, it's still in you, but you can't implement it in your life. You know, you have to go back to being a good boy, and that's where I think a lot of veterans have a hard time with the transition, and there was really no reintegration, when I was getting out. It was more or less just re-enlist or, you know, go on with it. So
I suspect, Tom and Brian, if I asked your wives how your transition was from the deployment to the civilian world, I might get a little more elaborate story. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. She'd tell you I've always been crazy, but
tell me about Baxter, Tom.
Yeah, Baxter's a field lab. I'm very fortunate. He came from the Leader Dog Academy. He was donated from the Leader Dog for the Blind Academy, I believe, out of Royal Oak. But he failed out because he was getting some ear infections. So they saw his good nature and his heart and just knew that he'd be a great dog to pair with a veteran, you know, struggling with PTSD and anxiety, because he had zero stress to the house. You know, he'll be two July 27th, so he's still a pup, but you wouldn't know it by, you know, just his work ethic. And, you know, everything that he does is to please, you know, to make me calmer. You know, I can just sense it about him. He follows me around the house, like Brian was saying, and he'll let me know he has a built-in clock. 8 o'clock comes around, and he just stares at me, waiting for me to get up and get that ball and get him outside. And, you know, that's something I didn't do for a long time. You know, I just worked and stayed inside the house. Didn't, you know, lost track of my hobbies and recreation that I used to enjoy, and he's getting me back there.
Well, I think one of the things, Tom, that you mentioned is that as you struggle with PTSD and anxiety, the dog helps you, Baxter helps you both in the house, and does he help you when you're out in society as well?
Oh, yeah, that's part of the training that we're doing now. I'm still in training with him, and he's more or less training me because he's already he's pretty smart dog. But, you know, even going to the store, you know, the wife would send me to the store with a list, and, you know, I'd miss 6 or 7 things off the list because I'd just be looking for the door, you know. And now I have him, and it's just a different feeling, you know, walking through. Obviously, you got people looking at you and stuff, but it's a bond that I have with the dog that we've built so fast that it just makes me more comfortable. And, you know, I don't forget the things off the list, and it just makes the experience more enjoyable.
We've had the chance to know some of the other vets and some of the other dogs from Stiggy's Dogs, and one of the things that I've noticed is that they help you not be hyper alert because they're already hyper alert. Is that something, Brian or Tom, that you've noticed as well?
Yeah, I'm sure Brian can attest to that. That's one thing they stress in training is, you know, with us, our head was always on a swivel. You know, looking when you're deployed or downrange, your senses are intensified. But here, it's the dog. You know, they're trained to look around corners and sit down if there's somebody coming up. And, you know, you kind of put that trust into the dog to be more vigilant for you because, you know, you can it drains you. If you're hypervigilant for too long, it's just mentally, you know, the stress from it drains you real quick. So the training goes a long way with the dogs when they take on that role.
One of the reasons I wanted to do this show was to have folks learn about service dogs. These aren't just companion dogs for you, are they?
No, he's part of the family. He has a job, but he also has a role with, you know, my two girls, my son's 5 months, and my wife. You know, he fits in really well.
Have you, either of you guys, been able to visit the VA with your service dog? Has that been something that's been accommodated, or are there still places like VA hospitals where service dogs aren't recognized as acceptable in the building?
You want to get one, Brian?
Go ahead, Brian.
And we actually do pet therapy where we visit the guys that are in the community living in the hospice section, too. So we go down one day a week as a pet therapy team to visit the veterans that are living there.
Excellent. Tom, I think I've got a note here that you worked with Coca-Cola, but maybe now you're moving on to another position. Where are you headed to, and do they acknowledge and accept your use of a service dog?
Oh, yeah. That's just recently. I had the opportunity to pursue a career where I can reach out and help, you know, our fellow heroes, you know, and brothers and sisters that are struggling. And, you know, I was in a unique position where I waited a long time to get help. And when I reached out for it, it just, all these wonderful people like Jennifer and all her trainers, Matt and Donna and everybody involved in Stiggy's, and, just found their way into my lives. And it's been one door after another opening up. And, you know, I have an opportunity now to be a project coordinator to plan events for veterans to come out and maybe, you know, reach out to the veterans that just now getting out to get the help earlier so they don't wait as long and, you know, dig themselves in a hole. There's a lot of passion involved, and they have 100%. They're on board with, you know, bringing my dog. We'll be, you know, trucking it through 4,500 acres of state land looking for a good spot to get those Michigan Rangers out.
There you go. There you go. Let me bring Jennifer back into the conversation. I wanted to ask Jennifer how she's sort of seen over time it develop on the acceptance of service dogs, whether it be at VA or elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but first I have to comment because I was wanting to say stuff about both of the both Tom and Brian are being really coy. And Brian not only takes Rusty back to the VA to help out with other veterans, but he also worked really hard to get to take his dog to the Children's Hospital. And they also go and work back at the Children's Hospital. And, you know, just like with Tom, wanting to give back and excited to have this new point in his career, I think that's one of the biggest things that we have seen. Like, you know, our head has been down and all focused on finding these dogs and pairing this and what our program does. But outside of it, you know, these guys have all become friends or their wives and families, and we've created a big family. And, you know, I could sit here and talk all day long about how good these dogs are and what and the changes we've seen, but just sitting here listening to both those guys, you know, and I think the biggest correlation is that these veterans are now getting out of the house, A, and B, they're not just these guys but other ones in our organization. They're giving back to other veterans. I mean, how cool is that?
No, I think that's got to be very rewarding for Jennifer and Stiggy's dogs. Can you tell us a little bit about who some of your partners are in making this all work and how it gets funded? Does the VA give you money? How does this happen?
No. And what would be other with our funding is donations. I mean, you know, and all of this that we do and the training and everything is all free of charge. You know, not just the dogs, but they get their tools that they need for them, you know, toys and vests. And so it is expensive, and it is a lot of personal funding. We have worked really well and is starting to make a lot of business relationships with our community. We're in Livingston County. Home Depot has been wonderful. They're wonderful for veterans, and we've gotten grants from them. Comcast, we've gotten grants from them. So, you know, we're starting to work with some bigger businesses and getting that funding as well. But, you know, it's still hard. It's still a struggle. And your question about, you know, working with the VAs, they have been really acceptable with our dogs, but we've also worked really hard to create that relationship too. And that was part of having us be here, because we can work with, you know, Detroit Medical, and we can be with Ann Arbor. Last year we were asked to speak at their grand rounds with, for their PTSD and TBI unit, to talk with the doctors and, you know, really us to talk back and forth about what the need is and what we can do to help. So, and you know, Jennifer, by building those relationships, it's made it easier.
And, Jennifer, do the service dogs wear a distinctive harness or jacket when they're out
no.
working?
And I'm glad you asked that, because I did want to say that we do have Representative David Kmusik did put a bill that he just proposed in Michigan this year to change that, because really the laws are really, really vague. You do not have to technically have any kind of identification for a service dog. So really what we're trying to do with this is have identification. There should be a state registry that you can go to, so we can see the service dogs, and that's going to definitely help, because, you know, there's always somebody that can just go buy a vest, or, you know, a dog that's not trained is being slipped through the system. So,
well, that you hear a little background music going, Jennifer. We're getting close to the end. Can you
quit
give
talking?
Us,
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
thank
no,
you.
No, no, no. Hang on. Before anybody goes here, I want you to give out your website again, so how they can find you and donate to Stiggy's Dogs.
We are at stiggysdogs.org, stiggysdogs.org. Thank you.
And we're glad to have the opportunity to promote Stiggy's Dogs and service dogs in general to our listening audience. And we are, it's time to say goodbye. Make sure you hit us on Facebook. Thanks to Jennifer and Tom and Brian for participating. And again, this is Veterans Radio. You are dismissed.